I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about Electing Our Future, the Center for Civic Literacy's project on voter apathy. We're going to discuss why so few Hoosiers vote and what can be done about it. My guests are Whitney Fields, an IUPUI graduate student involved with organizing the project, Dr. Laura Merrifield Albright, assistant professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis, and Dr. Matt Bergbauer, assistant professor of American politics at Indiana State University. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. Today we're going to be talking about the Center for Civic Literacy's Electing Our Future. It's a voter apathy project. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Whitney Fields, who's an IUPUI graduate student who's involved with organizing the project, Dr. Laura Merrifield Albright, who is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis and who's written extensively on the gender and race gap in campaign finance and state legislative races, and Dr. Matt Bergbauer. He's calling in by phone. He is an assistant professor of American politics at Indiana State University, and his research interests include state politics, campaigns, and voting behavior. Well, welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. Let's start first. We probably ought to talk a little bit about what the project is, what Electing Our Future involves, and how it got started. Should I start with you on that, Whitney?
Sure, that'd be great. So Electing Our Future is a three-part series of voter education forums from the Center for Civic Literacy. So the Center for Civic Literacy, I guess get a little bit of a background, is a center located at IUPUI looking at lack in civic knowledge and what that means for our country as a whole. So it's alarming when we have figures that 36% of Americans can name the three branches of government, 35% of teenagers recognize that we the people is the first three words of the Constitution, and only 5% of high school seniors can identify the checks and balance system. So that's sort of the work we do. So we identified this project, Electing Our Future, to sort of minimize those barriers. So as people go to the polls in November, they have a more educated idea of how Indianapolis works, the issues we face, and so they can feel more engaged and educated in our political process.
And we probably ought to talk about what the project is then, that it's this forum where the motivation came for. And in part, it's because Indiana is not stacking up particularly well these days. Laura, you're laughing, so I'm going to use that as the cue.
I am. We're rather notorious, actually, in the 2004 midterms. No, to be fair, we didn't have a governor's race, and we weren't electing a senator, but we had the lowest voter turnout. We were at 28%. Which is really embarrassing, especially when you consider the lowest across the country. So this is a project that allows us to inform voters and hopefully really inspire people to make good decisions at the polls.
Matt, break that down for me. 28% is, you know, again, it's dangerous when journalists do math, but that's just slightly more than one out of every four people who's eligible to vote in the state, right?
Correct.
Correct. And what accounts for that? Why are we know we are at the bottom. Which states were at the top?
Well, the states that are at the top, generally speaking, are the ones that have the least amount of burden on voter registration and on turning out to vote. And so when we look at states like Minnesota and Maine, we see same-day registration process where if you're not registered to vote by mid-October or late October, it's not a big deal. You come in on election day, you can register to vote the same day as you vote at the same place that you vote. And so those burdens are eased, and maybe a little bit more encouragement for people who move a lot or young people can actually turn out to vote. Now, we always see low voter turnout during non-presidential election years, and Indiana just made the case in 2014. Of course, it's going to go up in 2016. I can't say whether or not Indiana is going to be a swing state, and that could even more increase the maybe a little enthusiasm in the state of Indiana. But in presidential races, even if it's predeterminedly decided in Indiana, you still get over 50% of the vote or the registered voters to turn out to vote, and we're always looking to increase that.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Center for Civic Literacy's Electing Our Future. It's a project that's examining and attempting to deal with voter apathy. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Brett has done and just give us a call at 866-476-3881. Brett, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey. Happy Constitution Day, everybody.
Yes.
I live out here in Hendricks County, and although I generally vote in them, but I didn't vote in the last primary just because there's so many offices, you know, down ticket that run unopposed, and it's like, you know, what's the point? Mm-hmm. So I blew it off, plus I was working, and, you know, I'm in favor of having a national holiday. Why shouldn't voting day be a national holiday? So, I don't know, go with it. Bernie Sanders is talking about that like that, so go Bernie. You know, national holiday for voting day or a holiday.
Okay, well, we'll take that idea up. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Brett.
All right, thanks.
Take care. Well, Laura, I mean, that also gets to some of the reasons maybe why people don't turn out. Would making Election Day a holiday help things?
Yeah, I mean, I think the general consensus is that it would. It would talk about alleviating one of those burdens in terms of a cost. So you wouldn't have to take off time from work for people who have that kind of option. You would have easier transportation if it's not involving your work day and things like that. If we made it into a holiday, it could ease it for a lot of people. But I think you also have to consider the fact that we do have polls that are open for a certain amount of time. You know, I think it'd be wonderful to have it as a national holiday, but there are other things we could do to also increase the voter turnout.
What, have we identified factors? I mean, so far, just very quickly, we've talked about the fact that perhaps the registration process is more cumbersome than it needs to be.
Yes.
That we don't make the window in which people can vote as open as it might be. Are there other factors? I'm going to let all three of you jump in on this one because I suspect there are a lot of them that tend to suppress voter turnout. I'll let Whitney go first there.
Sure. So last week, Nuvo, if any of you saw it, put out a really great piece of why should I care? So it sought to answer that question of why should voters care? And they profiled two people who showcase why they didn't vote, and it's because they don't feel engaged in the political process and they're not informed, more particularly on a local level. They feel engaged on a national level because they could get the resources and the knowledge to vote, an educated vote on the national level, but lacked that knowledge on the local level and didn't know where to go for that knowledge. So that's sort of what the forums are trying to get at, is how to break down barriers and get that knowledge to voters who feel more confident to vote and don't choose not to vote just because they're not aware or informed.
And Matt, I'll throw this question, I think, to you, because one of the things that Brett alluded to was the idea that in many of the races, the candidates are unopposed. Mm-hmm. Is part of the problem that many of our elections are not that competitive now?
Sure. There is some political science research out there that suggests competitive races can get more voters enthused about the race and more engaged with the race. I'm of the opinion that voters have some responsibilities on their part to learn and be knowledgeable and be civically aware. But I also of the opinion that parties and candidates have a role to play as well, and they need to reach out to the public and ask for their vote and get them or convince them why their vote matters and why they should vote for him or her. So I take on a responsibility on the parties, on the candidates, and the campaigns themselves to also inspire people that politics is a good thing, that turning out the vote, being civically engaged is a responsibility amongst the citizens.
Laura, is this problem getting worse? I mean, we mentioned Indiana was dead last in 2014. Have we always been that way? Or is this an accelerating trend?
In general, we've seen, with the exception of the 2008 presidential elections, a kind of a decrease in terms of voter turnout for registered voters.
And for those who have short memories, that was a year that Indiana really was a swing
state. Yes, and we could argue that was an anomaly in a couple different ways. So there's something special about 2008. But generally speaking, we'd say there's been a decrease in voter turnout. We can say that part of it is because registered voters, we'd say when we're incarcerating more people, felons have to get voting rights reinstated, and that varies from state to state. Obviously, you have to be a citizen in order to become a voter. And we'd be remiss in the state of Indiana, we didn't talk about voter ID laws. That's another thing that where we have relatively rigorous requirements in order to have a voter ID that you have to show at the polls. That could be an additional cost that's going to kind of keep some people away.
And I'm going to stay with you for a second, Laura. Sure. Have we seen evidence in other places that say voter ID laws tend to suppress turnout? Because, the argument on the other side, the folks in probably this is one of those moments when I ought to do a disclosure and say that at one time I was the executive director of what is now the ACLU of Indiana, which opposes voter ID laws historically. Is there evidence that supports the other side's contention that really the only people that a voter ID law stops from voting is the person who isn't entitled to vote in the first place?
Well, we do notice that the states that have the more rigorous voter ID laws also tend to be the ones that have the lowest in terms of voter turnout. Now, you can argue there are a couple different factors that are included in that. But when you consider the fact that if you don't already have a driver's license, and keep in mind the kind of people that may not have that, certainly if you live in an urban area, if you don't have the money to have one, if you don't own a car, things like that, you have to go ahead and get an ID separately, which is free, but you still have to go through the state to do that. We would think that that's part of the reason you have the lower voter turnout, because you're isolating a particular group. Now, of course, the argument for those is to make sure that you have people saying who they are, and they are who they say they are when they're actually showing out to the polls. So it's a balance.
And I'll stick with you for just a second more. We should emphasize Indiana is not the only state, right?
Oh, not at all. No, we're right up there with Alabama. A number of states have them. Ours tend to be more rigorous than others.
And what ways is ours more rigorous?
Oh, in terms of the ID itself. So it needs to be state issued. It has to have a picture. You need to have your name on it. States vary in terms of what they require that ID to be.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Center for Civic Literacy's Electing Our Future. It's a project that is studying and attempting to deal with voter apathy. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Whitney, this project so far, we've talked about what it does. How did it come together? I mean, it's not just IUPUI. There are other partners involved. Who are some of those partners, and what are their goals for it?
So we have the Greater Indianapolis Progress Committee, the Indiana Bar Foundation, Humanities Council, Neighborhood Resource Center, the New Chamber, Public Library, Urban League, IUPUI, obviously, the League of Women Voters, NUVO, WFYI, just to name a few. So, I mean, their goal with this, I mean, educated voters affect all parts of our city, not just our political candidates. So the partners involved in this and the sponsors recognize that, and recognize that there's a need for increased voter turnout and increased knowledge in that. So that's sort of where that came together in terms of a partnership to just more provide knowledge for voters to take to the poll.
Whitney, I'm going to stay with you for a second and say, the argument, and you will hear it, and it's sort of a classic, frankly, American position from sort of the classic conservative American tradition that says, you know, if you're really not educated about the issues, we don't want you voting. How do you counter that argument? Got about 30 seconds.
That's a hard argument to counter.
If you need more time, we can pick it up after the break, I promise you.
Sure. I think in theory we run on a democratic process. So in order for that to vote, we need people, in order for that to work, we need people to vote. Granted, an educated vote is the best vote, but this apathy part of not being educated and not voting is kind of a cop-out, if you will. I think it's easy to pick it up a little bit and educate yourself, at least on the basics.
We are talking about the Center for Civic Literacy's Electing Our Future. It's a voter apathy project. My guests are Whitney Fields, Laura Merrifield Albright, and Matt Bergbauer. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about voter apathy today. The springboard is the Center for Civic Literacy's Electing Our Future. It's a project that is focused on both studying and contending with voter apathy. My guests are Whitney Fields, who's an IUPUI graduate student involved with organizing the project, Dr. Laura Merrifield Albright, who is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis, who's also written extensively on the gender and race gap in campaign finance in state legislative races, and Dr. Matt Bergbauer, who is assistant professor of American politics at Indiana State University. His research interests include state politics, campaigns, and voting behavior. We have a tweet from a listener named Molly. And if you'd like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Molly says, I don't like to vote in primaries because of the required one-party ticket. Can you explain why I should vote in these elections? Matt, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Well, Indiana's a fairly friendly state on that note because it does not keep official records and for that purpose. Other states have as a closed primary where you have to register as a Republican or register as a Democrat, and the state of Indiana doesn't do that. So if you wanted to even vote Democratic primary one year and then a Republican primary another year, you can do that. So they do limit you to one of the two ballots, of course, and the logic, I suppose, is they don't want you to vote for the best candidate in the one and the worst candidate in the other, and they have a lopsided race when it comes to the general race. But my other two guests on the panel may have additional insight on that.
Yeah, although one would argue that counters kind of that conservative argument. If you're savvy enough to think, I'm going to vote for the best candidate on the side I like and the worst candidate on the other, that's a fairly sophisticated understanding of the process, right?
It is. Laura? And we call it party rating. There's no proof that it happens at a mass level. And when you used to have blanket primaries, California had them, I believe Louisiana, and there's one other state. And they were declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court for that very reason. You couldn't vote in both and then essentially try to tank the opponent and raise up your proponent. But I agree with what Matt's saying. We have a relatively friendly system, and I think it encourages people to participate.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Sharon, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Sharon says, why vote? For example, your judges in Marion County have been pre-selected in a pay-to-play position. The law was just ruled unconstitutional but hasn't been replaced. Whitney, I'll let you tackle that one first, but I'm going to give everybody a crack at it. And I think that gives us kind of a soft opening into the whole question of gerrymandering, too.
Sure. I think vote by not voting, you're sort of letting the powers that be and the way the current political system works, by opting out, you're letting that system just perpetuate. So by getting engaged and having a voter voice, it's a small step in trying to change that system and make your voice heard in a democratic process.
Laura, I'll give you Sharon's question is, refers to the judges in an unconstitutional system that still hasn't been replaced.
Sure. And that situation itself is really unfortunate and obviously needs to be rectified. I would say in general, though, when you vote, even if you think the likelihood that your vote maybe doesn't matter or it's not the identifying vote, the fact is it's the one very rare time when government actually asks your opinion on something. And you have a right to voice that opinion. They tax you. They provide functions and services on your behalf. And so it's your way, essentially, to say who you want in office and whose ideas and values you support.
Well, I guess where I'd go, and I will take this all the way into the issue of gerrymandering, because, you know, I have not, I will admit, I have been remiss. I have not looked at the figures from 2014 yet, and I should have. But I know in 2012, for example, in Indiana, about 53.5% of the state's voters voted for Republican candidates for the Indiana House of Representatives. But because of the way the maps were drawn, the state GOP ended up with 69% of the seats. That's about a 15.5% swing. Does that send a signal to some people that really, even if they do show up, their voice doesn't matter because the system is rigged in such a way that they're stripped of that voice? I'll go with Laura, but I want to hear Matt's thoughts on that, too. So, Laura, you go first.
Sure. I mean, my first thing would be, hopefully it does send a signal. And I would say, well, then you need to really work on reelecting people. If you think the tricky thing with gerrymandering is people are actually selecting their own voters when it occurs through Congress or a number
and
of states.
It's really supposed to be the other way around.
Yes, exactly. You're picking your voters when you are drawing your districts as the incumbent. But I think that makes a really good argument. Challenge those incumbents. Question who's drawing these maps and really think about who you're voting for. In some ways, it provides more impetus to participate.
I agree with everything that Laura said. However, I'd add that, once again, that's a pretty sophisticated stat, and I'm not sure how many of the average voter would actually recognize some of that discrepancy. Going back to the original question of voter turnout, Brent's observation of national holidays strong. We have this idea of opening a ballot booth on 7 a.m., closing it at 5 p.m. or 6 p.m., and if you work that day, you have a really hard time finding the opportunity to vote. And maybe the tweet question was getting at that as well, of what's the inspiration to vote. Now, I can't speak intelligently about the Marion County judge race. However, I'm of the opinion that every voter should be represented fairly in their state house, in their governor's office, and, of course, U.S. Congress and the presidency. And if there are segments of the population being unrepresented or poorly represented in the voting process, like the Latinos are right now, then I'm concerned. So we have certain groups, whether it be religion, race, gender, that are not voting at the same percentage as other groups. And Latinos are really low right now, and that has effects on representation. And that's my biggest concern on why every segment, age groups, race groups, religious groups, should turn out to vote, so we can get that fair, balanced representation going on, state, local, national.
We are talking about voter turnout here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Art, welcome to the program.
Greetings. How are you?
Doing well. How about you?
Just fine. I think if we're really interested in achieving improvements in voter turnout, we have to address the issue of apathy and build concern and create a desire to be involved, make a meaningful contribution, and make a difference. To do that, I would propose that we should get people of various different ages and all walks of life involved in participating in a survey of needs and problems in the community of different citizens that they would go out and survey and talk to. And then as they did that, they would the positive emotions of involvement and learning as they go. And as they did that, they would find certain recurring themes, some of which would be of more interest than others. And as that interest would build, they would be more vested in the system. And then they would come into a group and analyze the needs and sort them into general areas and categories, and then go back and try to figure out priorities and things like that, and go back again to the people they talked to the first time and query them further, and to try to really understand what they said the first time, with maybe thoughts that they would have generated to ask additional questions. And then and in the process, they would be expanding the whole voter imagination and concern. So it wouldn't be just those people who are doing the survey, but people who are on the receiving end of the survey, which would be a great many more people.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm gonna.
That's number one. And number two.
Real quickly then, Art.
Number two, my other idea is, I think Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, and maybe South Bend used to always have an annual state model legislature for high school kids. High school state model legislature, which would have 150 kids simulating the Senate and the House, and then with all the other party whips and all that kind of stuff. And that would give a certain number of kids per year a really in-depth insight into how the Indiana legislative system works. And if you have a need and you see a need and you get it vetted by, you know, a particular congressman's aide, that then once you have a bill written that he would help you to write, then you'd know how to propose it and get it through the system and get it voted into law.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call.
Then you would have made a contribution and you would have made a difference in the process. You'd understand the process better and you'd be much more committed to be involved every year in our government, in our governance system.
Thanks very much for the call, Art. I'm going to give our panelists a chance to respond. Whitney, I'll start with you. With that first question, really, it sounds like he's speaking to one of the, you know, the focuses of what you're trying to do with this project is to re-engage people on the question of voting, right?
Exactly. When he was speaking to that, that's sort of what these forums are trying to do, is a community engagement tool so people can come and learn more and feel engaged in the political process on a community level. So more particularly on October 6th, our second of the forums will lay out sort of the issues that Indianapolis faces. And these forums are not just intended as presentations. They're engagement pieces. So community members can come to those and express bipartisanly what they feel are the issues that Indianapolis faces and what they think that we should do about those.
And his second question, I'll throw it to Matt and then Laura, is really about creating more models for young people to begin to be involved in the process before they're even of voting age. Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. I've read some literature, seen this debate for many years now. I like those advocates, like the IUPUI Civic Literacy Center. I like the push on emphasizing civics at the primary education level. So you teach them at it. You teach these individuals at a younger level the importance of government, how it affects people's lives, what they can do when they turn 18 and become citizens of the United States, and it starts the process of having them engaged, become lifelong learners, become lifelong engaged in politics.
Laura.
Yeah, I agree with everything Matt's saying, and I'd like to expand on that. It's interesting, we do so much geared towards K-12 students and getting them excited about civic participation and excited about voting in particular, when the irony is that up until senior year of high school, depending how old you are, you most likely can't actually vote to that point. I think we need to expand our educational initiatives, things like we're doing with the community forums, but to include adults in this process and really keep them informed, updated, and excited about the process.
We've gotten a couple of emails that deal with a similar theme, and they're from listeners named Michelle and Colleen. And I should say, if you want to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Michelle and Colleen, I'm going to take the liberty of combining yours, because you're speaking to a similar theme. Were you saying one of the disincentives for voting is that there is a lack of faith that candidates are actually responsive to voters, that in fact they're, you know, Colleen says that basically they're in the thrall of special interest groups instead, who have much deeper pockets that the average voter cannot access. Your thoughts on that, Laura?
Well, I understand Colleen's point, and I think it's very true to be wary of the special interest groups, particularly in terms of campaign finance. But the nice thing with elections, those are job security points for politicians. And so if you don't like someone in office, if they didn't do what they said they were going to do a campaign, elect them out. Vote for their opposition. Voice your opinion while they're in office. You can write to your elected official, call them, mention things at community forums. I think there are a lot of different opportunities that you have, even if you don't have deep pockets, to still be involved in the system.
gotten an email from Jeff. And Matt, I'm going to throw this one your way. Jeff, a listener named Jeff, who says, as I understand it, Australia has a law requiring everyone of voting age to vote. There is a fine levied for those who do not. I'm not sure of the fine, but seem to recall it being about $25. Any thoughts on this? I mean, do we approach this from the wrong direction here? Should we instead say voting, and we've heard the cliche, voting is a privilege, when in fact it sounds like Australia is saying voting is a duty.
Sure. So our presidential races over the past five cycles have seen increased slow but steady increases in voter turnout, which is good. Comparatively speaking, with other nations in the world, we are quite low. And Australia is one of a few nations, particularly Western democracies, that are doing very well on high voter turnout. So that makes a lot of scholars scratch their head and say, what are they doing right and what are we doing wrong? Australia is one of a few that has this law or a fine for not voting. Of course, it'll be controversial if explored in the United States. I can't tell you how seriously it has been explored. But nonetheless, if it were to be explored seriously, I'm afraid that this liberty string that we have in Americans, whether it echoes the Obamacare debate to other government regulations on individual lives debates, it'll be hated quite a well.
Well, and I'll throw that, Laura, and I'll put on my old ACLU cap here. I could see with any sort of change in the process that required you to vote and fined you to vote, that there would be, for not voting, there would be First Amendment problems because, the First Amendment protects your right not to say something as much as it protects your right to say it.
Exactly. And choosing not to vote, you still made a choice. You've abstained from the process. I agree with everything Matt was saying, and I think the biggest thing, it would go against the odds of a number of different factors when we think of what makes American democracy so special. So I'm not sure that we necessarily want to require people to vote, but we want to make sure that people have the opportunity to be informed and ultimately participate in the voting process.
Got a Facebook question from Jennifer, and if you'd like to reach out to us via social media, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Jennifer says, you say education is key for voters. How do we reach out to the younger generation? Should we start in high school or sooner to emphasize the importance of voting? Personally, my mother was my biggest impact, taking me to the polls when she voted. How do we get the younger generation to the polls? Whitney, I'm going to throw that one to you because you're nodding your head.
Sure. Mm-hmm. That is the age-old question, right? I think making voting cool again, especially on to a younger population who may be engaged in their communities in other ways, but not politically. So why is that? I think it's because especially my group or population of people think that our government system and our politics don't actually represent us. So making sort of the case that in order to change that, you need to vote, and making voting more a civic duty than I think our generation tends to look at it, and making our politicians look like us and represent us and actually take our needs of the community into office.
Well, and I'm going to play devil's advocate with you,
sure,
for a second here, Whitney. And that sounds like the eat your vegetables approach to civic engagement.
Sure.
I think Jennifer's question was much more, how do we make it seem fun again? What are there ways? And I know they've tried Rock the Vote and all sorts of efforts to do that have had middling success at best. Are there ways that we can make it more entertaining? I'll let Whitney or Laura take that one.
I know there are some models, online models, that turn games into political engagement. So having kids, especially at an elementary age, play games and educating those younger students about just the principles and the foundation of our government. So as they're learning this, feel more engaged as they get older. I think it starts young and teaching younger students about our country, how our country operates. So as they get older, feel more invested in it. And like I said, making it fun, like a game, especially with elementary school students, would be a start.
We are talking about Electing Our Future. It's a voter apathy project from the Center for Civic Literacy. My guests are Whitney Fields, Laura Merrifield Albright, and Dr. Matt Bergbauer. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the Center for Civic Literacy's Electing Our Future. It is a project designed to study and contend with voter apathy, which here in Indiana is at almost epidemic proportions. My guests are Whitney Fields, who is an IUPUI graduate student involved with organizing the project, Dr. Laura Merrifield Albright, who is assistant professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis, and Dr. Matt Bergbauer, who is assistant professor of American politics at Indiana State University. We have gotten an email from a listener named Brian, who adds another level of complexity to this. And I should say, if you want to reach out to us by email, you can send the email to us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Brian says, what about the people who don't register to vote so they do not have to serve on jury duty? Matt.
I'm not very sympathetic towards that argument. Maybe I should be. I'm afraid it's a little bit of a cop-out. I think that's a bit of a myth now, but I can't speak for every state on that matter. I'd like to think that the benefits of voting, when here we talk about civic duty, we know that your one vote's not going to be the difference maker in every race, if any races at all, of course, but you do it for the sense of citizenship. And so jury duty, as one of my constitutional law professors once said a long time ago, that's one of the best forms of being a citizen as well, is serving on jury.
Gotten an email from a listener named Jennifer who says, I think that disenfranchisement is a major issue. Folks who have been incarcerated, served their time, been released, often cannot vote. What is Indiana's stance pursuant to this matter, and is anyone working here in Indiana on opening up the vote to everyone? There's a whole generation of kids who don't see their parents voting because of these issues, so they're less likely to grow up and vote themselves. And she takes in another direction. Why not an opt-out instead of a registration process? Laura, I'll throw that one your way.
Sure. Well, I think Jennifer brings up a great issue, and I'm not sure if there are any specific groups particularly working towards enfranchising, particularly in terms of felons and their voting rights, and that varies from state to state how you get those reinstated. But I think it is a major issue. When we look at differences between actual voters, people who are able to register to vote, and then the whole population, you see with more people being incarcerated, obviously that diminishes the number of people who are able to register to vote. So I think it's a great question. I'm not sure specifically who's working towards it, but maybe that's something Jennifer can participate in.
We're getting a lot of emails, and I'd like to thank our listeners for them. This one is from Darcy. It says, the message I have taken away from political conversations and social media is that it's not just voter ID laws and gerrymandering. It's also that they are disappointed in the candidates available. For many, not voting has been their way of saying none of the above. It has seemed the last few election cycles, our state Democratic Party has assumed that our state is so conservative that they must be conservative to get elected. As a result, Indiana Democrats have not had candidates they can be excited about. Perhaps they should entertain the possibility that we are not all that conservative. Matt, I know you've got to run to teach a class a bit, so I'm going to throw that one to you.
Sure. I'm reminded of something I said earlier about candidates inspiring voters and campaigns mobilizing to get voters to turn out for them. I do also see a sense of voters just looking at two candidates and being unexcited, just looking at two candidates and being unmotivated, voting for the least of the two. I've heard that line before as well. As technology grows, more people are running for office, but nonetheless, we still have improvements to do on that note. I think the parties have responsibility in recruiting good candidates, and it starts at the local level, and then they breed up from there and start running for statewide offices. And so parties have a big responsibility in recruiting people of all ages, races, gender, so on and so forth, good candidates at the local level so they can rise up and be at the state level where we recognize them and get inspired by them.
as is so often the case, we are getting all of the best questions near the end of the program. So I'm going to ask both our callers and emailers and our panelists to try to be concise here so we can give as many people as possible a chance to comment. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
I have so much on my mind, but I think, you know, having these candidates, these prototypical candidates, that just seem like instead of, I think, our founders, they wanted the businessmen, you know, the farmers, the gentlemen, elite, the military. That's, they wanted them to come in, serve a small, you know, stint as a politician, as a congressman, as a state representative, and then move on. And now we just have these career politicians who are, where, you know, people just look with disdain upon them. And I think that's where a lot of apathy is coming from. And I'll just go ahead and hang up now.
Thanks very much for the call, Greg. Laura, I'll throw that one your way.
Sure. Well, a good way to counter that would be to institute term limits. And obviously for Congress, we don't have those in place, so it allows people to serve multiple consecutive terms. That's where we get these career politicians. On the alternative side, if you've been in the institution for a long time, presumably you'd have a better understanding of how politics works. You'd make connections, and you'd be able to potentially get more done. So that's kind of the debate that goes on between those ideas.
Gotten an email question that says, is there a correlation between the number of possible voters that are ignorant of government structure and those that do not vote? I'll throw that one to Whitney first, but I suspect Matt would have some thoughts on that, too.
I do not have stats and numbers to answer on an educated term on that, but it's a very valid point.
Matt, what are your thoughts?
So your thoughts on, like, intelligent voting and whether or not to turn out to vote?
Well, it says, is there a correlation between the number of possible voters who are ignorant of government structure? In other words, the ones Whitney listed at the top of the show when she talked about how few people can identify basic constitutional mm-hmm. concepts and mm-hmm. all of that, and those that do not vote. That, in fact, if I think the numbers were somewhere in the 30% mm-hmm. range, 36 at the high end, 5% at the low end of people who couldn't identify significant
sure.
parts of our political structure, and only 28% of the Hoosiers vote.
Sure, sure. There is a correlation between uninformed individuals and not voting. And those uninformed individuals are also disinterested, either in politics or the campaign of that year. So it's a challenge to get them interested and then ultimately informed. One of the things I'm concerned about, if I can elaborate a little bit more, is this notion of we want people informed. We also have that notion of misinformed and uninformed individuals. And misinformed is the worst. So we want people to definitely be accurate in their information and where the candidates stand, and then they can match up those issues and beliefs of the candidates with their own values and beliefs. And that match is really important to me, so we can get this notion of voting, not only turning out to vote, but also voting for the right candidate for them. And then we're talking about accurate representation and the issues and direction of the nation is actually a reflection of the citizens.
And Matt, I think that's a great last word for you. I know you got to go run and teach a class. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, John.
Certainly. Thank you. We've gotten an email from a listener named Tiffany who says, my 17-year-old daughter told me just yesterday that she wasn't planning on voting when she turns 18 because she is learning in school that her vote doesn't really count. Mm-hmm. She said the Electoral College makes the decision so that her vote doesn't matter. I am sure that her teacher didn't say that her vote doesn't count, but somehow that is the message she is hearing. That whole Electoral College thing is something we haven't even talked about, that we, you know, that there is, in effect, this filter on what would otherwise be a purely representative or Democratic vote.
It is. And even though you have that difference in the Electoral College versus the popular vote, I always like to remind students and everyone in general, if you think, well, that only refers to the presidency. And while obviously that's the most visible campaign, that's the one where people turn out the most in terms of elections, we have no Electoral College for state offices. We have no Electoral College for congressional offices or even for the local level. So if you even sweep aside that, just think of the popular vote. Well, it matters in every other race, and it really does matter.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named James. If you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. James says one reason for low voter turnout could be the sense of frustration with the two-party system. Maybe if independents were allowed to vote in the primary elections, more people would vote. Is there any chance of that happening in Indiana? Whitney, I'm going to go to you first on that one. Is part of the problem, I'm going to get the first part of James' question first, that we just don't have enough choices here? I mean, there are self-governing societies in other parts of the world where you're not limited to, you know, chocolate or vanilla. Is that part of the problem?
I would agree to that on a little bit, but I would counter that, especially on the local level, like run yourself. If you have issues with the political system, the local level is a way to get engaged. So if you don't think there's enough candidates or candidates represent you, it's really easy to get engaged. Run for city county council, start that way, and get more people in there who represent you. And if you're that apathetic about the system that doesn't represent you, then make a choice and run yourself.
And Laura, is there any chance that this system would change here in Indiana?
Ooh, in Indiana or the United States as a two-party system? Probably not. But
in part because the two parties have a pretty strong vested interest in preserving it.
They do, exactly. But I'd also like to point out, sure, for the primaries, you don't have much of a say, but the primaries are to select who's going to represent the party. In the general election, as independents, you can run. And I think that's really where, especially if you identify as an independent, look at who's running on the party levels. If it doesn't impact you enough to actually vote in the primaries, well, just make sure you turn out for a good independent candidate in the general election.
We are talking about voter apathy here on No Limits. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I just an observation and maybe looking to get a reaction, but I get the sense from being in politics that it really seems to be in the best interest of both parties, both major parties, to drive down turnout and really just deal with the hardest of their base, so that they are in a race to get only those voters that they can easily identify as being along party lines to turn out. So I'm just curious as to the panel's reaction to sort of the antithetical behavior of the two parties as it relates to truly enticing or incentivizing turnout for most of the voter population.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Paul. Laura, I'll throw that one to you first. But there are political professionals who will tell you, off the record, obviously, tell me off the record, that a large part of what they do is try to discourage undecided voters or swing voters from voting because they can predict outcomes more easily if it's only the most committed voters coming
in. Sure. And you don't want to have that risk necessarily. I think when you look at the two parties, both parties would have incentive to do that. I would also look at who their base is. Generally speaking, Republicans tend to be homogenous. They tend to be a little bit more organized. They tend to come out to polls more. More people identify as Democrats historically, but they don't always go to the polls for a number of cost-benefit, however they determine it, those kind of analyses. But the parties themselves would have incentive, as you suggest, to keep down those questionable voters and just really draw out their base. That's who's going to elect them. That's who's going to ultimately select them into office.
And Whitney, we've got a comment question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, who says wants to say, and I think this is a theme you've been trying to pound away at during the course of this conversation, says wants to say to non-voters that close elections have been determined by 1 to 2 votes in some cases, so your vote does matter.
Exactly. And to follow up on Laura's previous point about being manipulated by uneducated voters, that's more of an incentive to educate yourself and dig deeper. Don't just listen to TV ads, news ads, like dig really deeper into a more intimate level of your candidates and what they actually stand for, not just what they tell you on the TV or an ad. So you're not sort of being taken advantage of and swayed one way or the other way. Yeah.
We have gotten a Facebook question message from Steve, who actually wants to correct a bit of misinformation, it looks like. Thank you, Steve, for that. Steve says, I have been summoned for jury duty twice already and have been informed both times that jury pool selection is performed no longer using voter registration, rather from Bureau of Motor Vehicles, so you're going to have to do without your car, utility, or as well as tax records. So feel free to vote. I'm assuming that that's a good development. Laura, you're smiling.
I was going to say, I think that's great. Now you have no excuse to register to vote. You don't even have to worry about jury duty, though, yeah, if you have a car, that may be something you want to consider.
Yeah, or you're willing to do without water and power and all sorts of other things as well. We are talking about voter apathy here on No Limits. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Certainly.
And terrific topic. I have a real quick comment and then a question. One is, my experience is that democracy is an active verb, not a noun. And that people who go, why is that, why should I vote, or have not had enough experience to know that it's part of the dynamics that makes our country possible and makes it special. My question is wondering if you've heard of any plans to recruit people to work the polls on election day, and this means helping to check them in, check voters in, hand out ballots, and there's a formal process, and the clerk of the Marion County Clerk's Office can recruit and place you. You do not have to be a member of the political party. And bottom line, this is part of the dynamics of democracy. So my question is, have you heard of anyone actively recruiting people for Election Day to work the polls?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Margaret. I'll throw that one to Laura first.
Thank you.
Well, yes, thank you, Margaret. I haven't heard of anyone actively doing that, though that could just be my own personal knowledge. So I would certainly encourage listeners to look out for that, to seek that information on their own. And I love the idea that democracy is an active verb. I always think of it as democracy necessitates participation. It's the same idea. You have to participate. You have to be involved. And otherwise, we don't really have a democratic system. It doesn't work that way.
Whitney, I'm going to ask, I've been remiss here. Doubtless there is a website or someplace where people can go and get information about this project, Electing Our Future. Could you give them the URL and tell them a little bit about what they would find there?
Of course. So the URL is www.electingourfuture.com. The events will be September 21st, October 6th, and October 20th. All of that is on our website. We have registration via Eventbrite on our website as well. Follow us on the hashtag Electing Our Future. Would encourage you all to reach out at CivLit on our Twitter account and tell us why you're apathetic to voting and what we can do to change that.
Is there a cost to attending?
Nope, these
cost
events?
Is so free.
It's free. And
so
open to the public.
Eventbrite is just reserving your spot. Then,
correct.
Right.
Yep.
And the three events are again the dates so that people can plan.
Sure. Monday, September 21st. Tuesday, October 6th. And Tuesday, October 20th.
Okay. Well, I think that is an appropriate last word. I would like to thank my guests, Whitney Fields, Dr. Laura Merrifield Albright, and Dr. Matt Bergbauer. I've enjoyed talking with all of you. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
It's been wonderful. Thank you for having us.
Oh,
yes.
Certainly.
Thank you, John.
Glad to do it. Also would like to thank all of our listeners and apologize that we could not get to even more of your questions. I can promise you this is not the last time we're going to talk about this subject. There will be future shows. So please stay tuned and realize that you will have a chance to get your question asked or your comment offered in the future. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.